Thanks very much, Stephen, and thank you very much to the ABE for the invitation to come and speak this evening. It's both an honour and a privilege for me to be able to join your annual dinner. This evening I want to talk about an issue that I know is close to the hearts of many of you. It's also one that you've been discussing this afternoon, and that's economic forecasting. As economists, forecasting is something we're required to do almost on a daily basis. As a policy advisor, or as an investor, or as a business person, we have no choice but to be forward-looking, to think about the central scenario and to think about the risks around that scenario. So for many of us, some form of forecasting, with all its difficulties and with all its pitfalls, is the bread and butter of our professional lives. But tonight I want to talk about three aspects of forecasting from the perspective of a central banker. The first is the role that forecasts play in the setting of monetary policy. The second is the approach to forecasting that we use on a day-to-day basis at the Reserve Bank. And the third is a couple of issues that we've been grappling with recently as we put our forecasts together. Now, as many of you know, Australia's monetary policy framework is best described as a medium-term inflation target. Over time, we want to ensure that inflation averages between 2 and 3%. And since this framework has been in operation, this is exactly what's happened. Since 1993, CPI inflation, excluding the effects of the introduction of the GST, has averaged exactly 2.5%. And as you can see from this first chart here, there's a marked contrast to the experience of the previous two decades where inflation averaged nearly 9%. One of the important features of this inflation targeting framework is that it's forward-looking. We know it takes time for changes in monetary policy to have their full effect on the economy, just as it takes time for changes in other economic variables, the terms of trade or government spending, to have their full effect. This means that if we are to achieve our medium-term objectives and at the same time avoid unnecessary swings in the economy, we need to be thinking about what might happen in the future. Now, when inflation targeting regimes were first introduced around the world, many observers characterised the appropriate policy rule as setting the interest rate so that the inflation forecast was at the midpoint of the target band at some specific horizon, normally around 2 years. And it was also often argued that for reasons of enhancing the credibility of the central bank, there should be some form of penalty on the bank if inflation moved outside the target band. In effect, the edges were to be viewed as an electric fence to be avoided at all costs, if possible. Now, this form of inflation targeting never seemed particularly attractive to us at the Reserve Bank of Australia. While we're committed to ensuring that inflation outcomes are consistent with the medium-term target, we have not felt the need to set the cash rate so that our inflation forecast at a specific horizon is always exactly 2.5%. Nor have we felt the edges of the target are like an electric fence. We have, from the outset, had a more flexible approach than this. Since the current framework has been in operation, our two-year ahead inflation forecast has on occasions been below 2%, and on other occasions it's been 3% or higher. And in terms of actual outcomes, year-ended CPI inflation has been outside the 2 to 3% range a bit more often than it's been within the range. All this has occurred while achieving an average rate of inflation, as I said, exactly 2.5%. Now, this more flexible approach has two main advantages. The first is in the event that inflation turns out to be too high or too low, the central bank has some flexibility about the pace at which inflation is returned to the target. And provided the central bank's commitment to medium-term price stability is credible, this flexibility can deliver better outcomes for the real economy. And the second advantage is that the flexibility provides greater scope to take into account not just the central forecast, but also the medium-term risks around that forecasts. And I'd like to try and make this a little more concrete by asking you to think about a specific example. and that is an economy that experiences a positive supply-side shock, say an improvement in productivity or lower world prices for the goods that it imports. Now, normally, this type of shock would be expected to boost economic growth, increase asset returns and lower inflation, at least for a while. What then is the right monetary policy response in this economy? In a world in which the setting of the policy is determined solely by the 2-year ahead inflation forecast, the answer may well be to lower interest rates. If inflation is forecast to be lower than the target midpoint in 2 years' time, lower interest rates, at least for a while, would help get inflation closer to the target. But would lower interest rates in this economy be the best response? To answer this, I'd need to tell you more parts of the story. If asset prices were rising quickly, if investors were very exuberant about the future, and the financial sector was making credit liberally available on generous terms, then lowering interest rates simply to hit the inflation target at one specific point in the future may not be the best response. Experience has taught us that low interest rates at a time of rapid increases in leverage and asset prices can pose significant medium-term risk to both the outlook for the economy and for inflation. Ignoring these risks and making leverage cheaper by lowering interest rates simply to ensure that the short-term inflation forecast was at the target is unlikely to be the best response. The general point here is that while a central forecast for inflation itself will often be a good guide to policy, this won't always be the case. On some occasions, the medium-term risks are just as important. Now, it's sometimes argued that one way to deal with these risks is to simply extend the forecast horizon to, say, 3 years. So instead of setting the interest rate so that the 2-year ahead of forecast is at the midpoint of the target, set it so the 3-year forecast is at the midpoint of the target. Now, this idea of thinking about what might happen beyond just the next 2 years makes a lot of sense. But a mechanical response of just extending the forecast horizon is probably not the best approach. The further out one goes, the less certain one can be about the future. As we all know, it's hard enough to make judgments about the risks that the economy faces, let alone forecasting exactly when those risks might actually materialise. And this makes it very difficult to incorporate the future realisation of risks into central forecasts. While we might have a reasonable degree of confidence that some particular risk will materialise at some point, predicting that point is extremely difficult. In my own view, then, this means that just extending the forecast horizon to 3 years or some other horizon is an unsatisfactory way of dealing with the risks we face. The better approach is to have a flexible inflation target that effectively anchors medium-term inflation expectations but provides the scope to take account of the various risks that arise in the complicated world in which we live. This means that we need to be thinking about the whole distribution of possible outcomes, both in the short term and the medium term, and not just the point forecasts over the next 1 or 2 years. Under this approach, at times, the 2-year inflation forecast will be away from the midpoint of the target band. The flexibility embedded in this approach obviously needs to be exercised with care, and probably relatively rarely, but good policy means that on occasions this flexibility does need to be utilised. Now, I hope it doesn't come as a surprise to you that in setting monetary policy from month to month, the RBA board spends a lot of time discussing the likely evolution of inflation and output and the risks facing the economy. In late 2008, when the outlook took a turn for the worse and the downside risks increased, the board lowered the cash rate very quickly and in large steps, despite inflation at the time being above the target band. Then in late 2009 and early 2010, when the outlook had brightened, the cash rate was increased with lending rates returning to around average levels. And just last month, the board again increased the cash rate, with the result that monetary policy is now judged to be slightly on the restrictive side. This latest decision was not taken because the economy is currently growing too quickly or that inflation is currently too high. Clearly, neither is the case. Rather, it was made on the basis of the outlook for output and inflation. With the economy currently operating with relatively limited spare capacity, at a time when a substantial lift in investment is expected, it was judged that inflation was more likely to rise than fall over the next few years. And given this, the board judged that it was prudent to make an early and a modest adjustment to the cash rate. In doing so, it has sought to reduce the probability of inflation rising to uncomfortably high levels and thus requiring a more substantial increase in interest rates later on. Now, before I turn to the forecasting process itself, I want to emphasise that the board's decisions are not driven in a mechanical way by the numerical forecasts. Both the bank staff and the board are very conscious of the limitations of these numerical forecasts. Predicting exactly which quarter inflation is likely to increase and at what pace is inherently difficult. What is often more useful is the analysis and the storyline that supports these numerical forecasts. And it's this analysis, rather than the exact numbers, that is rightly the main focus of our internal discussions, and rightly it's the focus of our communication with the public. Now I'd like to talk a bit about the actual forecasting process that we use on a day-to-day basis. As many of you know, we publish a table that sets out our forecasts of inflation and growth in each quarter in the Statement of Monetary Policy. We also discuss the broad analysis underlying these forecasts and the main risks facing the economy. Consistent with our general approach, we do this in words rather than using fan charts showing statistical bands of uncertainty has become popular in some other countries. The forecasts that we publish are discussed at the board meeting just 3 days earlier, and they're developed through a series of internal meetings over the preceding month. And outside of this quarterly cycle, the forecasts are kept under constant review by the staff. And the actual forecasting process has three key elements. The first is the day-to-day assessment of the economy. The second is the use of a number of formal econometric models. And the third is the information that we gain from our extensive business liaison program. And I just want to make a few comments about each of these. The obvious starting point is to understand what is currently happening in the economy and the financial system and what that means for the future. In our economic analysis department, there are around 50 economists whose job it is to continually monitor the pulse of both the domestic and the global economies. And elsewhere in the bank staff are analysing developments in the financial system and in the financial markets. Inevitably, the data we look at are subject to measurement error and they're often conflicting. This means that much of our time is spent discussing the data and what they tell us about the recent past as well as the future. Judgment is obviously critical here, and the strong collective memory of the bank staff play a very important role. The judgments that are reached, though, are anchored by some underlying economic relationships and concepts. So as we prepare our forecasts each quarter, we're constantly asking ourselves questions such as how much spare capacity does the economy have? What constitutes full employment? What's the neutral real interest rate? What's the potential growth rate of the economy? What's the state of private sector balance sheets? And how well anchored are inflation expectations? And I know many of you in this room ask the same questions on a regular basis. But in most cases, it isn't possible to come up with definitive answers to these questions. And the bank certainly does not have doctrinaire views. What we do is continually confront our conditional assessments with the ongoing flow of data. When things turn out differently to what we expect, we study the outcomes very closely to see what we can learn. And this process of continual testing, learning, and then retesting is really at the core of our forecasting processes. The second element is the use of a suite of forecasting models. This suite includes simple single equation models, multi-dimensional vector autoregressive models, and an estimated DSGE model. We use this suite rather than just a single model because of the considerable uncertainties in the modelling process. Most of the time we're looking for the central tendency of the various models, and we use them to inform the judgmental process that I just talked about. And the models are also used extensively in the formulation of various scenarios when we're considering the risks to the economy. The third part of the forecasting process is our liaison with business. Each month, the RBA staff across the country hold roughly 100 meetings with businesses and various agencies in an effort to better understand what's happening in the economy right now and what's likely to happen in the future. And over recent years, a couple of examples stand out where this liaison has been particularly valuable. One was in helping us understand the implications of the much tighter credit conditions in 2008 and 2009, and the other has been helping us understand the scale and the timing of the pickup investment in the resources sector. In both cases, our liaison has provided us with extremely valuable information that I don't think was available elsewhere, and it's had a significant role in shaping our general forecasts. So that is, in a nutshell, is how we go about forecasting. It's really a combination of judgment, formal models and liaison. And as I said a few minutes ago, it's as much about the underlying analysis and the storyline as it is about any particular set of numbers. I'd now like to turn to a couple of practical considerations that we've been thinking about as we've put our forecasts together over recent times. The first of these is the implications of a significant increase in Australia's stock of physical capital. As the Governor spoke about at length last week, Australia is experiencing a perhaps once-in-a-century boom in the terms of trade, and this largely reflects the urbanisation and industrialisation of the populous countries of Asia. This boom has increased the average return on physical capital in Australia, while clearly there are variations across sectors and the return on capital in some sectors has declined. But the increase in the average return on capital means that it is plausible to argue that the optimal capital stock in Australia has increased, and perhaps significantly so. Not surprisingly then, the ratio of business investment to GDP has been very high over the past 5 years, and it's expected to remain high over the coming years. As you can see from this next chart here, since 2005, Australia's capital stock, if we exclude dwellings, is estimated to have increased at an average annual rate of around 5.5%. That's up a full 2 percentage points from the average growth in our capital stock over the previous quarter of a century. One implication of this pickup in investment is a pickup in the growth of the economy's overall capital-labour ratio. Again, if you just look at the last 25 years, this ratio increased, or the 25 years to 2005, this ratio increased at an average annual rate of 1.75%. But as you can see, over the past 5 years, it's increased at twice this pace. And this faster rate of growth is likely to continue for quite a while yet. In effect, we're becoming a more capital-intensive economy, with the movements in world prices that we've seen leading to a significant expansion of the resources sector, which is one of the most capital-intensive parts of the economy. And from a forecasting perspective, this raises a whole host of quite interesting questions, and I want to touch on quite quickly on three of them. The first is the implications for the growth rate of potential output. If everything else were constant, faster growth in the capital stock should lead to faster growth in potential output. And if we use a simple production function and hold everything else constant, the 2 percentage point increase in the growth rate of the capital stock that we've seen would lift potential output growth by 0.5 percentage point or possibly a bit more. But of course, everything else has not been constant. In particular, you can see from this next chart that total factor productivity growth has slowed down significantly over the past decade. Indeed, according to the national accounts, almost all the growth in output since the early 2000s has been accounted for by growth in labour and capital inputs rather than by improving the way that we use that labour and capital. So the forecasting issue here is whether this is likely to continue or whether a return to closer than average productivity growth will see potential output grow a little more quickly than we've become accustomed to over the past decade. The latter is clearly the preferable outcome, although, as Stephen was speaking about before, there is yet little sign that productivity growth is picking up. Our second question that comes from this rise in the optimal capital stock is the implications for inflation. If indeed potential output growth were to pick up, this would mean that the economy could grow more quickly over the medium term without causing inflation to rise. But in the short term, producing and installing this increased capital adds to demand pressure in the economy. Of course, one way that these demand pressures can be mitigated is by importing the required machinery and equipment, and to some extent this is what has been happening. Much of the physical capital for a number of large resource projects is by necessity imported, and the appreciation of the exchange rate has lowered the relative price of capital goods from abroad. And as you can see from this next chart, imports of capital goods have grown considerably more quickly than investment over time. Yet even as we rely more on imported machinery and equipment to increase the capital stock, it takes significant domestic resources to install this imported machinery and equipment. So the forecasting issue here is to what extent the period of accelerated growth in the capital stock will affect inflation pressures in the economy, and to what extent these pressures can be reduced by importing capital goods in particular from abroad. The third question I want to touch on is the implications for the risk profile of the economy of having this higher capital stock. While the central scenario that we face is a very positive one, there are risks. In the late 1980s, for example, we saw a large increase in the capital stock, particularly of commercial buildings, but when the recession came, much of the investment in this capital had to be written off, and the result was large losses to the banks and investors. Similarly, there is no guarantee that the current wave of investment will earn the high returns that it's currently expected to earn. So the relevant forecasting question here is how these risks are likely to play out and how they influence by the way in which the increase in the capital stock is financed. So in thinking about each of these three questions, the impact on potential growth, the implications for inflation, the changing risk profile of the economy, it's really this combination of judgment, models and liaison that I spoke about a few moments ago that we rely on. As in other areas, we don't have fixed views, but what we're doing is constantly testing, learning and retesting as the data come in. A second issue shaping our forecasts that I'd like to talk about is the attitude of households to spending and to borrowing. Over the past year or so, we've had the rather unusual situation in which the households, when surveyed, report they're quite optimistic about the future. Yet at the same time, they're quite restrained in both their spending and their borrowing. While measuring saving rates is notoriously difficult, as you can see from this next chart, the latest national counts show a very marked increase in the household saving rate over recent years. And the increase has fully reversed the decline that took place from the end of the 1980s to mid-2003. Somewhat remarkably, the increase in the household saving rate in Australia, at least as measured by the ABS, has been larger than that of many other countries, including the United States, where household balance sheet repair is a major factor weighing on the economy. And as you can see in this next chart, unlike in the United States, where household confidence is very low, the rise in saving has occurred in Australia at a time when confidence is reportedly very high. Now, there are a number of explanations for the increase in household savings in Australia, but it's likely that the most important is a rethinking of attitudes to debt and spending following the events in the global economy of the past few years. It would appear that many households now view high levels of debt and low levels of saving as more risky than they did previously, and this has led some to save a little more and others to borrow a little less. And the strong growth in household incomes over the past year has made this a little easier to do. The forecasting issue here is how persistent is this change likely to be? Is it just a temporary phenomenon that will wane as memories of the GFC fade? Or has there been a long-lasting change in attitudes after two decades of rapid increases in household borrowing? It's difficult to know what the right answer is, but the restraint currently being exhibited by the household sector is turning out to be quite long-lasting. In preparing our own forecast, we have for some time been assuming that the household saving rate stays quite high for a while yet. If this were to occur, not only would it lead to a lowering of risk in household balance sheets, but it would also reduce inflationary pressures in the economy during the period of high investment. So this is obviously an area that we're watching very closely, and it's one, again, where our approach of testing, learning and the retesting is important as we review our forecasts. So in summary, there's no shortage of interesting issues to ponder over as we think about the future. The world economy is undergoing fundamental change as the weight of economic activity moves from the North Atlantic economies to those in Asia, and as the household sectors of many countries rethink their attitudes to both spending and borrowing. These are important structural changes, and they are likely to shape the Australian and the global economies for some years to come. I wish you luck in incorporating these changes into your central forecasts and the risks around those forecasts, and I thank you very much for listening, and I wish you all the best for 2011. Thank you.
Phil, Mike Thomas from Access Economics. You mentioned early on that after 17 years or so of inflation targeting that you were running at 2.5% right in the middle of the band. That implies that you could go for 17 years running at 3.5% before you break through the top of the band on average. Now, that's not really realistic, so I was wondering what is a realistic time frame for hitting your 2.5% average?
Well, there's no mechanical way of calculating this, but what we really want the community to understand is that over long periods of time, inflation will average something like 2.5%, and most of the time when inflation's away from that, we'll be heading back to 2.5%. And there's no kind of mechanical way in which this can be judged. Obviously, if we inflation was for 17 years 3.5%, I think people would start to wonder whether we're really committed to achieving 2.5% inflation. So there's no magic formula. We want to convince the public that that's what we're trying to do, to anchor inflation expectations, and that when we're away from 2.5%, most of the time we'll be trying to get back there within a reasonable time frame.
Phil, David Plank from Deutsche Bank. One of the issues, obviously, is the international outlook. I'm just wondering how you do your business liaisons within Australia. What do you take in terms of your global outlook? Do you take consensus forecasts? Do you do your own? Just if you could run us through how you take into account the global economy in your forecasting process.
Well, we largely rely on a combination of the outside forecast, the IMF forecast, and our own team. I'd say that's particularly the case when we're looking at the large... We're relying on our own team when we're looking at the large economies in Asia. As Stephen spoke about before, China and, to some extent, India are incredibly important to us. And so we have quite a large team looking at those two economies, particularly the Chinese economy. And we find that we've needed to do that because much of the analysis that you read on the Chinese economy is not particularly detailed, and we felt we've needed to put more resources into that. And so we spend a lot of time trying to understand what's going on there. So it's really a combination of relying on external sources and making our own judgments, particularly when we think we've got some value added compared to the consensus forecasts.
Hi, Philip. I was very interested in your charts on the capital stock and what that means for potential growth, although I'm not sure you told us what your new potential growth figure is. nor what that full employment figure is that you said you think about a lot as well. But what I'm really interested in is a lot of that growth is concentrated in the mining sector, and presumably we'll see an enormous expansion of output and perhaps GDP from the mining sector. But of course your inflation target is a household type measure and may be more responsive to conditions in the rest of the economy as opposed to what's occurring in the mining sector. So does an expansion or an improvement in potential output from that one sector mean that we can rest easily about inflation in the rest of the economy? Or are you thinking as seriously about those sectoral impacts as well?
We think a lot about the sectoral impacts. Often the expansion of the resources sector is thought about in terms of just the investment in the resources sector, and obviously that putting in place all that investment adds to demand pressures in the economy. What really doesn't get as much attention are the implications of the higher commodity prices for national income. And if the terms of trade now were where they were averaging through the 1990s, will national income per head, so really the effective purchasing power that we all have, or at least on average, that would be between 12 and 15% lower than it currently is. And that all that extra income eventually finds its way around the economy. So there are parts of the economy that aren't directly related to the mining industry that are doing reasonably well at the moment because these income effects are flowing through. There are other parts, obviously, that aren't doing so well, partly because of the restraint that the household sector is showing. And the parts that are directly related to the mining sector providing the capital goods and actually doing the investment there are doing very well. So we're looking at all that all the time. As I said, we've got this very extensive liaison program. We feel we understand the various pressures in the economy. And the aggregate picture is one that the economy is growing close to trend at the moment. And we think it'll pick up a little over the next couple of years. But understanding these cross currents in the different sectors is very important. At the board, we spend a lot of time talking about it, and a lot of our internal time is spent talking about those cross currents as well.
My question's also on the capital ratio, particularly the slide you had on the capital labour ratio. Under the assumption that some of the capital that's coming into the country, either in the importation or the construction or the implementation phase or even in the usage phase, is going to require labour inputs, you could make the conclusion that that will put more pressure on the existing labour stock. Is that something that the Reserve's thinking about, particularly given that we're now seeing that the federal government's actually lowered its population forecast on the back of lower overseas migration? Is that an inflationary risk that will have to be managed in the future?
Well, it's undoubtedly we have a strong labour market. I mean, employment's gone up by more than 3% over the past year. And the various partial indicators we track say that employment growth, at least over the next little while, is likely to remain reasonably firm. Whether immigration is a solution to stronger growth in the demand for labour, I think, is questionable. And I say that because when new immigrants come to the country, they certainly increase the supply of labour, but they also add to the demand for labour. Because when new immigrants come, they need to be equipped with their own capital stock, their house, the household effects. They also demand services. So I think when thinking about the effect of immigration on the tightness of the labour market, it's really about whether the immigration can be targeted to address specific bottlenecks in the economy and whether supply constraints are really tight. And if you can do that, then immigration can help reduce the inflation pressures in the economy. But if it's just general immigration, you've got to balance up the extra demand for labour that the new immigrants effectively create through requiring both domestic goods and services versus the supply effect. And my reading of that evidence is not clear. It's really got to be, if it's going to address the inflation pressure, it's got to be quite targeted.
Dr. Lowe, Gavin Stacey, Barclays. Just with respect to the early part of your presentation, you kept talking about the two-year-ahead forecast for inflation. But with respect to monetary policy, the general guideline is that, you know, the maximum effect is felt 12 months ahead. How do you mesh the sort of two-year ahead in CPI forecast with the monetary policy having a 12-month lag time?
Well, I think characterising monetary policy as just having a 12-month lag time probably isn't quite right. And it's very difficult to estimate precisely exactly what the profile is. But the work that we have done and many others have done suggests that the maximum effect is closer to 2 years rather than 1 year. And that's why when these inflation targeting regimes were first set up, the broad intellectual consensus was that you should be thinking about 2 years ahead, because that's effectively when the monetary policy response is having its maximum effect. And there are debates continually about whether these lags are shortening or lengthening, and I think the evidence is mixed there. But you know, I think 2 years, roughly speaking, for the maximum effect is probably sensible.
Warren Bird from Colonial First State. The ABS has been in the news the last couple of days talking about the results of the review of the CPI. The media have reported that you guys want a monthly CPI. The ABS thinks it's probably a good idea but needs more funding. What arguments are you exactly going to put to the government, if any, to support allocating the funding to get a monthly CPI? Or in the end, doesn't it really matter that much?
Well, I don't think we're going to engage in public advocacy here. We've made our points pretty clearly. We wrote a submission to the ABS review, which is publicly available, and in that we said that, in our judgment, having a monthly CPI was a sensible thing to do. Every country in the G20, bar Australia, has a monthly CPI. The IMF's standards on macroeconomic statistics suggest a monthly CPI. In the setting of monetary policy at the margin, it would be useful. It's best practice around the world, and I think the ABS has recognised that in its recent review. So it's really a matter for the ABS and the government about the funding of that. I think our views are pretty well known, but it's not a matter of public advocacy. I think the other comment I'd make about the ABS review is that we do welcome their decision to take the deposit and loans category out of the CPI. I think you can mount reasonable arguments why, conceptually, measuring what they set out to do was sensible, but it turned out that practically it was very, very difficult, and it was affecting the CPI in an undesirable way. And so the fact that the ABS has decided to take that, I think, is a welcome step.
Phil, my question's, you've already got a question about sectoral differences across the economy, and I've got Ross Gittins standing next to me here. So this afternoon, Ross pointed out it's not a two-speed economy, it's a multi-speed economy. But I'm thinking about Glenn Stevens at some point in the past at one of these nights, I think, suggested that it was the level of interest rates that was important, more so than the movement. And, you know, the latest movement in cash rates in December takes us, as Stephen said, to a slightly restrictive stance of monetary policy. And yet we seem to have had quite a substantial slowdown in domestically oriented parts of the economy, retailing and consumption, for example, housing and construction. And I guess I know there are other things happening there, including the end of the fiscal stimulus, the higher currency, which is related to the interest rates. But are you surprised to the extent to which the tightening so far does appear to have slowed down the domestically oriented parts of the economy, or is that pretty much in line with what you would have thought would have happened anyway?
Yeah. Well, there are two very big stories on the domestic economy. One is the pickup in investment. Now, in the national accounts, we saw investment up 2% in the private investment up 2% in the quarter, and I think as we go forward, we'll see quite large increases in investment. And what's happening on the investment side of the economy is as we had expected. There are quite a number of large projects that are either starting now or are likely to start in the near future, and the pickup in investment driven by the terms of trade, driven by the China, the India story, that's broadly on track. The other big story is this restraint in consumer spending. And that is turning out, as I said, to be quite long-lasting. And it's very difficult to predict how long that's going to remain in place. The good news, I think, out of that restraint is that it makes household balance sheets in a better shape. It reduces medium-term risks. And it also allows the economy to grow solidly, but not too quickly, while all this investment is taking place. So the retailers obviously don't like the slow growth in household consumption, but from a macroeconomic point of view, if investment really is going to be as strong as we think, I think it's broadly a welcome development.
Dr. Lowe, it's Sue Lannan here from the PM program from ABC Radio. When you saw the September quarter national accounts and that growth was flat, did you become concerned about the November rate rise? Did you feel that that had gone too far?
Certainly not. As I said in my remarks, the decision to increase interest rates is really about the medium-term risks, what we think inflation is going to do over the next couple of years. I think the encouraging thing in the September quarter national accounts was that investment, as I said, picked up, was up by 2% in the quarter. And the pickup investment has really been central to the story we've been telling about the economy. High terms of trade, the highest level effectively in a century, very high levels of investment, very fast growth in the capital stock, high levels of confidence in the resource sector. And what we saw in the national accounts was really the first statistical concrete evidence that that storyline was playing out. And I think what we saw in the capital expenditure survey just before the national accounts confirmed that. And what we've seen some other partial indicators of investment to suggest investment is indeed picking up. The national accounts from quarter to quarter will bounce around. We saw the previous quarter when it was originally published, I think it was a 1.2% rise for June. This one was lower than average. I think they bounce around. But the basic storylines that we've been tracking, I think, are pretty much as we thought they would be.
Can I just, sorry, have a follow-up, but what about the retail sector, construction, tourism? Do you see those industries as collateral damage for the mining boom?
It won't surprise you that my answer to that is no. I mean, there is structural adjustment occurring in the economy. I don't think we should duck that. And the economy I think it has some spare capacity, but fairly limited. And we know that there are parts of the economy that are going to go above average or above trend for a while, particularly those directly related to the resource sector, but as I said, also some of those that are benefiting from the income effects of the very high level of commodity prices. And with some sectors growing above trend, others, given we're starting from almost full employment, will inevitably grow below trend, and that's the type of adjustment that inevitably occurs in an economy suffering the very big changes that we have. So understand that's very difficult for some sectors, but in aggregate, the economy is better off having that structural adjustment than it being resisted.
Thanks. Ross Gittins of the Herald. Dr. Lowe, you say you'd really like to see a monthly CPI. It would greatly assist you in your work. The ABS says, yes, great idea. Unfortunately, it's very expensive producing a monthly CPI and we don't have the money. You say, wouldn't it be great if the government paid for this? The government says, we're in deficit, we're desperate to get back to surplus, we've got to pay off this debt, we have no money. It occurs to me that there aren't many outfits in this country with more money than the Reserve Bank of Australia. So why don't you pay for it? If it would so greatly assist you in doing your job.
That's a very interesting suggestion, but it's not one that I'm attracted to. And there is a serious reason for this. Our target is in terms of the CPI. I wonder what the public would make of the Reserve Bank having this target that's jointly agreed to by the bank and the government and then paying the ABS to actually collect the statistics that tell whether we meet the target. So I think this is better that the funding of the CPI as funding for the other ABS statistics is done from the general public purse rather than the Reserve Bank, because people would say, well, you know, it's your target and then you're paying someone to tell you whether you're meeting the target. I don't think that has the right flavour about it.
Dr. Lowe, Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. My question follows on some of the earlier themes. Since the Reserve Bank hiked in early November a month ago, we've had the official news from the statistician that non-farm GDP fell slightly in the third quarter and retail turnover fell sharply in the month of October. The non-mining economy overall looks about as weak as the Australian cricket team. The question is, you know, would the Reserve Bank like to apologise for killing Christmas for the retailers and squashing their growth prospects, or would the bank, you know, do well to explain more fully that in fact squashing the growth prospects of retailers and the tourism operators, the housing sector, the manufacturing sector is part and parcel of the plan to make room for the mining boom while keeping inflation low?
The restraint that we're seeing in the household sector, I think it's primarily the result of a change in attitudes and perceptions about risk. I mean, higher interest rates are no doubt having some role as well, but we're seeing right around the world, almost in every country, a very large increase in household saving. Now, I think it's quite plausible that the reason we're seeing this everywhere is because household sectors everywhere have reassessed the risks about having high levels of debt and having high consumption ratios. And that's the main story that's going on here. It's not high interest rates. The increase in interest rates is having some effect, I'm sure. But the big picture, the big story, is really a reassessment of the risks. And that, as I said before, that has some upside. It reduces the medium-term risk in household balance sheets and it reduces the demand pressures in the economy, allowing this investment to take place, which in expectation will generate very high returns for the country and allow then consumption to grow more solidly later on.
Phil, Andrew Byron from Barclays. There's quite a lot going on in the regulatory area globally at the moment, as well as in Australia, and the Reserve Bank has submitted to the inquiry into the Australian banking sector. I'm just wondering how much work the Reserve is actually doing in terms of incorporating that into its forecasting process.
Well, it's very difficult, as I'm sure you appreciate, kind of to know how to incorporate regulatory changes into macroeconomic forecasts. I think, in general, the tightening of global financial standards will lead to an increase in the cost of financial intermediation. Banks have to hold more capital, they have to hold more liquid assets, that they have more deposits relative to wholesale funding. And those things will tend to push up the general cost of financial intermediation. And they also mean that, at least globally, the availability of credit is a bit tighter than it otherwise would have been. So we're aware of those general effects, and we do the best we can in this judgmental process that we use of trying to incorporate those into our forecasts. And I'd have to say that the kind of the general rise in costs of financial intermediation is something that we talk about a lot. And as the Governor has said, and I've said on previous occasions, when we're setting our interest rates, when we're setting the cash rate, we're looking at the effect of our cash rate on lending rates in the economy, because it's ultimately the lending rates that affect
people's decisions. And the higher costs of financial intermediation means that the lending rates are higher relative to the cash rate, and we take that into account in the setting of the cash rate.
Jeff Rogo at Dow Jones. Not to get into an argument over who ruined Christmas or not, but the simple fact is that I won't make a lot of friends in this room with the idea that some of these banks did you a favor by doing more than you did in November. And I guess that the question is, as we talk about forecasting, how do you forecast and how does that come into your models, things like that, banks moving their rates beyond your moves? Is it about discussions? Is it looking at their books and thinking what they might do? I mean, how do you forecast? If your method is on what the actual lending rates are, how do you forecast how banks react on what you do?
Yeah. Well, we don't have a forecasting model for how banks respond to what we do. I think we listen to what people are saying. We talk to the banks. We listen to their public commentary. We try and understand the pressures that are on their funding costs. And you know, we do a lot of liaison with financial institutions and just a lot of observation of what's going on in financial markets and try and make an assessment there. But we don't have a crystal ball, and we do our best, as I'm sure you all do, in trying to work out what's going to happen here.
Mike Thomas, Access Economics. You just mentioned funding costs. Coming out of the GFC, a lot of the major banks benefited from the implicit government guarantee because they're too big to fail. The Reserve Bank does a lot of research into funding costs. How much is this implicit guarantee worth in basis points?
You're way away from my area of expertise, so I'm going to have to duck that question. I don't know that you can put a number on, and I certainly haven't seen any work to do that. So I'm sorry I can't answer that.
It's Sue Lannan again from ABC Radio. The federal government and the federal opposition say that the competition has been reduced in the banking sector, and the banks say there is competition, in particular in regards to home loans. Who's right?
Well, I'm not going to kind of get in the middle of that. I think kind of from the macroeconomic perspective, as I said before, what we're interested in is the actual lending rates in the economy. And broadly, the mortgage rates are where the Reserve Bank is comfortable with them being. We adjust, in setting out in the cash rate, we've adjusted where the cash rate would be because of the changes in funding costs and ultimately in lending rates. So from a macroeconomic perspective, The lending rates are broadly where the Reserve Bank is comfortable with them being, and the issue about whether there's enough competition, it's an issue that the public right should discuss. But from the macroeconomic point of view, it's the level of interest rates that's important, and the level is about where we think they should be.